Rebecca, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. A report out today says Saudi Arabia has warned the U.S. against pulling troops out of Iraq, saying that it would then be forced to protect the Iraqi Sunni minority from Shiite militias. Saudi Arabia sees itself as the leader of the world's Sunni Muslims. And joining us now to talk about this story is Christopher Dickey. He's Middle East regional editor for Newsweek magazine. Chris, a Saudi official today is denying that there was any warning against a U.S. pullout from Iraq, and Vice President Cheney was recently in Saudi Arabia. What was the message that Cheney brought back?
Well, I don't know exactly what was said to Cheney directly. We just are picking up sort of second, third, and fourth-hand accounts of that. But I think the concerns of the Saudis are fairly clear. They don't want to see an Iraq on their border that is dominated by Iran, whether it's the whole nation of Iraq or a large part of Iraq that's broken away. And they see that as a real possibility. So what they're talking about now is, what options do we have? Where do we go? Can we just accept this? No, they don't want to. And a lot of Saudis feel, and this is not only at the government level, but at the public level in Saudi Arabia, that they have a duty to try and support the Sunnis inside the country, who they believe will be the object of ethnic cleansing if they are left defenseless. In fact, the Sunnis are in a very strange position in Iraq right now, because they're fighting an insurgency against the Americans, but they also need the Americans to stay to protect them from the Shia. So it's one of those sort of incredibly thankless and difficult situations that has developed in Iraq.
Yeah, very complicated, I think. And I'm wondering if you think the position from Saudi Arabia, however it may have been expressed to Vice President Cheney, is one of the reasons why we're hearing from the White House that there's going to be a delay in any announcement of a new strategy in Iraq until after the new year.
I think that's possible, but I think it's also possible that, looking at the political timing, President Bush would like to come out with a statement about a change in policy that would be very clear, that would resonate, and that would be understood and not be sort of overwhelmed or somehow lost in sort of the general atmosphere of the holiday season, in which, you know, people just are not reading the news that carefully and not that focused on these kinds of issues. If you're going to make a big statement, you don't want to make it just before Christmas.
The report in the New York Times today also suggested that Saudi Arabia has pretty explicitly warned the U.S. against negotiating with Iran. You mentioned Iran before, and that's a real concern on the part of Saudi Arabia. But negotiating with Iran is one of the main recommendations from the Iraq Study Group. Again, part of the White House strategy in Iraq and as it considers what its new strategy will be. I'm wondering, what do you think these two different positions suggest?
I think the problem that the Saudis have is not with the idea of talking to Iran. The Saudis have diplomatic relations with Iran, and they talk to the Iranians all the time themselves. I think their concern is giving things away to Iran, making too many concessions to Iran. And that's a concern that's been raised about several points in the Baker-Hamilton report. Not only on the Saudi side, but for instance, the Israelis are very concerned about the part of the report that recommends talking to Syria and then offering to return the Golan, sort of on Israel's behalf. I don't think that the Saudi position is nearly as hard as the New York Times story suggests. I think that they are not against dialogue, but they do want to make sure that the Sunni interests in Iraq are not just sort of thrown aside in favor of a kind of policy that's another thing we've heard second and third hand coming out of Cheney's office, which is the idea that we really should represent, our policy should represent the interests of 80% of the Iraqi population, which would be the Shias and the Kurds, and really not be too concerned about those 20% who are Sunni. The final point probably to make on this is that the Saudi population, rich Saudis, have been supporting the insurgents in Iraq for a long time. It's been one of the big problems that the U.S. has tried to resolve quietly with the Saudi government, is how to crack down on Saudi citizens who are providing money and in some cases going to participate as suicide bombers in the insurgency. That's not the Saudi government policy, but it is something that the Saudi government has to be concerned about. And if they see a situation in which the Sunnis look as if they're going to be abandoned, they need to make some public démarche in which they say, we will not let this happen.
All right. Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There's more chaos in the Gaza Strip today after the brazen daytime murder of a Hamas official, apparently in response to this week's killings of three young boys whose father is a senior Fatah intelligence official. The boys were on their way to school in their father's car when as many as 15 gunmen opened fire. Hamas has denied responsibility, but the violence has led to concerns that the Palestinians are on the verge of civil war. It has also diminished any hopes of a unity government between the ruling Hamas party, considered a terrorist group by the West, and Fatah, the party founded by former Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Joining us from northern Israel is Boston Globe correspondent Thanasi Kambanis. Welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Can you describe the situation in Gaza? We're hearing people say that there are concerns about a possible civil war.
I don't think it's completely likely there'll be civil war, but there is a breaking point that's been reached in the Palestinian public. The violence we've seen in the last few days is nothing new. What is new is the level of outrage, particularly that prompted by the murder of the three children. What that's done is it's provoked a level of disgust that I've never seen or heard before from Palestinians in Gaza towards their own leadership, both towards the Hamas officials in government and towards the Fatah officials, who are widely viewed as corrupt and self-serving.
Usually when we hear some of these horrific stories, unfortunately, of Palestinian children being killed, we hear that Israel is being blamed. Can you explain this shift now, because it's really Hamas being blamed here?
It's interesting to pull back and think about what we've seen over the last year, which is increasingly tit-for-tat killings between Hamas functionaries and Fatah functionaries. And it's channeled a lot of the rage, as you said, that's usually reserved towards Israel, towards the Hamas government. And Hamas, understand, came into power in March with the mandate to really get security under control. People were tired of Fatah, and they said these Islamists are going to be strict and ethical, and they're really going to change our life for the better. And instead, what they saw was a continuation of the kind of lawlessness that, as we saw this week, is increasingly claiming not just gunmen, but innocent bystanders.
And in the case of these three children, it's my understanding, based on what I've read, that the shootings may have been in response to a crackdown on the part of the father against Hamas as long as 10 years ago. What does that say about what's happening? And I'm wondering, what does it say about the ability or inability of these two groups to be able to work together?
Old grudges die hard. And people are, people are still angry about things that happened in the early years of the Oslo Accord. But in response to the second part of your question, I think that really is the key here, which is, do either of these parties have the power to control even their own followers? And I think the answer is clearly no. Fatah can't control the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which regularly tanks agreements that they make. The same goes for Hamas, which has an armed wing that basically has a leadership and a mind of its own. When push comes to shove, I don't think any of these sides are going to be able to deliver on agreements they make, because their followers don't necessarily obey them.
The shooting that we talked about today of a Hamas commander outside the courthouse where he worked, and then the subsequent comments that we're hearing from the Hamas government saying that the government's not going to sit idly by in response to this shooting. How significant is this?
Well, I think it's very significant, and I think the worries about civil war have risen again to levels we haven't seen in a year. But historically, Palestinians have managed to always come together against Israel when their internal strife threatens to break out into a full war. And some of the analysts I talked to over the last few days said as much, that they expected any day now for the two factions to pull back from the brink by jointly attacking Israel, provoking some kind of catastrophic response from Israel, and using that to unite the people inside Gaza against a common external foe. If that doesn't happen, though, Deborah, I think we could start to see violence rising to levels that we could start to characterize as the beginnings of a civil war.
Boston Globe correspondent Thanasi Kambanis, thanks for speaking to us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
For more analysis of the situation in the Palestinian territories, we turn to Hai Melka. He's deputy director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And Haim, we just heard Zanasi Kambana say that while the Palestinians are not in civil war at the moment, it is a definite concern. What do you think?
Certainly, there's been speculation that Gaza and the Palestinian territories have been on the verge of civil war in the last 6 months. Every time they seem to reach the brink, they pull themselves back. And both sides see the civil war as really a red line for their relations. I think we're probably going to see ups and downs in these cycles of violence. I don't think we're going to see a full-blown civil war, but certainly there will be continuous clashes erupting every so often, and probably more assassinations, revenge attacks. People are frustrated, they're angry, they don't have regular salaries. All of that contributes to an atmosphere of violence and tension, and one little spark can spin things out of control and can be difficult to stop.
Well, the Hamas party, which came into power in January, controls parliament. It's negotiating with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah party to try to form a unity government. Those talks have been on again, off again. Can you tell us why the Palestinians need to form a unity government? What's at stake here?
That's a good question. There's a lot at stake for Palestinians. If they don't work together, they run the risk of escalating violence, as we've seen in the last few days. And if they don't work together, there's really no opportunity for them to be a credible negotiating partner with the Israelis. So I think a lot is at stake here. Basically, the future of the Palestinian themselves, the future of their government, their future of their political system, and any efforts to build a credible and viable Palestinian state.
Can you tell me, what are the main sticking points for the two sides to be able to form a national unity government?
The unity government is really part of a package deal that the Palestinians are trying to work out. Part of it is the unity government. Another one is the prisoner exchange with the Israelis. And another one is the ceasefire. So those three pillars, really, of this effort to build Palestinian unity. Fatah and Hamas have deep-seated and long fundamental problems between them going back since the early 90s. There's a lot of hatred on both sides, and those differences of leadership, personal differences, are clouding this effort to form a unity government. Beyond those issues, there's the issue of who will control the security forces, the interior ministry. They've come to a basic conclusion about what kind of person is going to be the new prime minister and a technocratic government that they've been trying to work out. But the issue of the interior ministry is a real sticking point for them.
And the issue of Israel.
That's correct. President Abbas has tried to link the issue of recognition of Israel as a precondition now for forming a unity government with Hamas. I think that's a real mistake because Hamas is not prepared at this point to recognize Israel. There's a question whether they will ever be able to recognize Israel. But I think linking that issue, which is such an existential issue for Hamas, to a unity government between Palestinians is definitely a roadblock for any progress.
That's Hai Melka with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. When we come back, life for the average Palestinian amid this increasing conflict between the two main political groups. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're back now with Hai Melka. He's deputy director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the escalating violence between the two main Palestinian political parties and how that's affecting efforts to form a unity government. And Hai, what does Hamas, the ruling party, gain by sharing power with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah party?
There is an effort to form a unity government. They have stuck to a ceasefire, although there have been violations of the ceasefire since in the last couple of weeks. It is in Hamas's interest to stabilize the Palestinian arena, to stabilize the relations between Israel and Palestinians, because if they don't, if violence continues, then Hamas is not going to be able to implement its own socio-political agenda, which it was elected on. It wants to change Palestinian society. It wants to improve governance. It wants to end corruption. And it's not going to be able to do any of those things if they're in constant struggle, not only with the Palestinians themselves, meaning Fatah, but with the Israelis as well. So there's a lot at stake here for Hamas. And I think ultimately it's in their interest to maintain a ceasefire, to try to reach an agreement, an accommodation with Fatah, and ultimately some type of an arrangement with the Israelis.
Those are hugely significant differences. I mean, are Fatah and Hamas, in your opinion, capable of sharing power?
A lot of people will say there cannot be a power-sharing arrangement. There has to be a winner and a loser in this battle. If they cannot work together, then there is no chance that the Palestinians will ever reach a viable Palestinian state, and they will not be able to work with Israel. That's the bottom line here.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is scheduled to make a speech Saturday, and he has hinted that he might call for early elections. Hamas officials say essentially that would be a coup.
It's a debatable point whether the president actually has the power, the presidential power, to call early elections. I doubt whether he can do that. He can certainly dismiss the cabinet or the government, but he cannot call early elections. And even if he were to call early elections, I seriously doubt that the outcome would be different than the outcome we have with the current Palestinian parliament. Fatah has been unable over the last year to really reform itself, to prove that it has some sort of governing agenda or some sort of a way to improve the livelihood of Palestinians and the Palestinian situation. And so with all of the unrest, with all the uncertainty, with all of the frustration, I'm not convinced that we would see a very different outcome.
And also, the Palestinian prime minister is on a month-long trip abroad that today he said he was going to cut short because of what's happening in Gaza. What do you think that means? Is that significant that that's happening?
I think the fact that he went on a month-long trip to begin with is significant, and the fact that he's cutting it short is also significant. And he needs to get back to try to put the brakes on the violence that could spiral out of control. I think the fact that he announced that he was going on a month-long trip demonstrates to Fatah that he doesn't see the issue of a unity government as so urgent. Hamas has been able to get funding from a lot of different sources. The international boycott or the Western boycott of the Hamas government is starting to crumble. And so I think it was a signal to Fatah that there was not an incredible urgency in trying to reach a unity government. He may be revisiting that now and cutting his trip short.
Let's go back to Israel for a moment as well. Israel suspended nearly all official contacts with the Palestinians after the Hamas movement came to power. And today, the Daily Star of Lebanon is reporting that Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has said he's ready to sit down at the table with the Palestinian president anytime, ready to cede territories, evacuate Jewish settlements. Is this something that you think is likely to happen?
They've suspended contact with the official Palestinian Authority, with the Hamas-led government. The contacts between the Israelis and President Abbas's office have been continuous. And in fact, senior advisors of Prime Minister Olmert went on a visit to Ramallah to meet with President Abbas just this week. So the contacts between the usual cast of characters that Israel has been dealing with for the last decade have continued. Prime Minister Olmert made a speech last week where he said that he was ready to sit down with the Palestinian government, with the Palestinians, and make far-reaching concessions if a technocratic government recognized Israel, recognized previous agreements, and renounced violence. That position is not a new one, and his position or his offer of far-reaching concessions to the Palestinians is also not new. It was basically his electoral agenda to come to power and to either unilaterally or with some sort of an arrangement with the Palestinians, withdraw from large parts of the West Bank. So I think it's really a repackaging of his previous position.
But until the Israelis and Palestinians do sit down at the table, the Israelis will continue their position withholding money to the Palestinians. Western nations have frozen millions of dollars worth of foreign aid, and the Palestinian government, consequently, has not been able to pay about 165,000 employees on a regular basis. How is that situation affecting the people there?
I think this idea that the Palestinians have been completely cut off is not entirely accurate. There has been money flowing from Europe. there has been money flowing from the United States as well as other Arab states. That money has been channeled around the Hamas-led government. So U.S. funds are going directly to the office of the president, in particular to strengthen his security forces in the event that there is a showdown between Hamas and Fatah in the future. And European money has continued to flow throughout the last year. And in fact, I think close to $850 million has been channeled to Palestinian institutions that are not part of the government to help ordinary Palestinians. But nonetheless, it's not enough. People are suffering, and it's extremely tenuous situation there.
Chaim Melka, Deputy Director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Tomorrow on Here and Now, a look at American fundamentalism and how the Christian right is rewriting U.S. history. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Funding for In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Gulag. Even the word sounds ugly, and it should. Gulag is the acronym for the vast network of forced labor camps in the Soviet Union during the reign of Joseph Stalin. The word has since been used to describe places of terrific hardship where political prisoners are held. More than 20 million people passed through the Soviet camps. Millions died in them. And despite its dimensions, the Soviet Gulag remains largely unstudied in the West. Now, a series of exhibits at Boston University offers a portal into these monuments of human tragedy. Here and Now's Ken Shulman toured the shows and has this report.
Judging from this newsreel, life in the Soviet Union under Communist Party leader Joseph Stalin was paradise. There were bakeries stocked with bread, department stores with stylish ladies' hats and shoes, muscled workmen welding girders on a skyscraper. At a youth congress, a young pioneer thanks Stalin for his unflagging support of the working class. To the health of Stalin! Long live Stalin! But Stalin's Soviet Union was anything but paradise, as we can see at Gulag, one of three related exhibits at Boston University. Gulag is a recreation and reflection on Stalin's infamous penal system. The brutal conditions of the prison camps are presented in posters, dioramas, and kiosks. So is the propaganda campaign the Soviets used to conceal these lagers from the world. An acronym for Glavnye Upravlenie Lagerei, the government agency that ran the nation's prison system, the Gulag provided the Soviet Union with a vast slave labor force. It also gave the totalitarian state a powerful threat to suppress dissent and resistance. People were sent to camps for murder and assault. They were sent for laughing at a joke. They were sent for no reason at all. And no one, not even party leaders or heroes of the revolution, was immune.
When the people who initiated terror, they were acting on the assumption that they will always control the terror.
Alexander Gribanov is a literary scholar and a former human rights activist in Moscow. It was precisely this randomness, he says, that made the terror so effective.
And that was one of the greatest mistakes. Nobody can control the terror. If it's a mass terror, nobody can control it. And the executioners will be victims in the next step. And they could not resist. They couldn't resist it for the simple reason because they were guilty. They were not guilty in the crimes they were accused, but still they were guilty. They knew their part in the terror.
In 1956, in a historic speech at the 10th Communist Party Congress, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev denounced the crimes committed by his predecessor, Stalin, crimes including the Gulag. A brief period of openness followed. This so-called thaw ended in 1964 when Khrushchev was deposed. The new Soviet regime clamped down on discussion and dissent. But this time, there was an opposition ready to fight for basic freedoms. In Faces of Resistance, a companion exhibit to Gulag, we see black and white portraits of Soviet dissidents who stood up to the Kremlin from the 1960s until the fall of communism. Drawn from the Andrei Sakharov archives, the portraits are profiles in courage and sacrifice. These brave men and women paid for their daring. Most lost their jobs. Many were forced into exile or sentenced to indefinite stays in mental hospitals. Some even committed suicide. Tatiana Yankelevich is the daughter of Elena Bonner, human rights activist and widow of Nobel Peace Prize winner Andrei Sakharov. She says these dissidents knew exactly what they were risking.
Yes, I think they understood it. But there was something that was really stronger than fear. And maybe the desire to overcome that fear and behave as a citizen and as a personally responsible human being was stronger than that fear. And I think that in most cases, everyone you see here had the support and the understanding of their family. And without that, they would not have been able, I think, to endure.
In a third show titled Territories of Terror, seven contemporary Russian emigre artists have created installations inspired by the Gulag. Stalin's prison system may be long gone, but these works show that the specter of those camps still haunts the Russian soul. In Archaeologist's Collection, an installation by artist Grisha Bruskin, we see 49 painted bronze fragments mounted on pins. The fragments represent characters from the Soviet national mythology. In Bruskin's installation, they are displayed as if they were artifacts from an ancient, vanished world. Svetlana Boym is professor of Russian and Slavic literatures at Harvard. She curated Territories of Terror.
Great creator of rockets. We see him as a little rocket, a military man, a doctor, a prisoner of Gulag. And Bruskin himself commented that the figure of a prisoner of Gulag can stand as a figure or the symbol for the whole collection, because any member of the collection, including the pioneer or the rocket scientist, could have ended up in Gulag.
Half a century has passed since Khrushchev's historic speech, and the Gulag is still largely unknown to the public. There is no Schindler's Gulag list. Territories of Terror is one of the first contemporary exhibits to weigh the legacy of the Soviet camps. Part of this collective act of forgetting, says Boyne, is due to the images generated from Stalinist-era newsreels, posters, paintings, and movie musicals like this one, images that transform the ragged inmates into rugged heroes. Many people simply didn't want to believe that the terror was real.
In order to deal with the experience, you have to deal with this machine of dissimulation, which is very hard to deal with because some of the dreams that are represented in this art is the dreams many of us or many people in the West would have liked to believe in.
The lessons of the Gulag are difficult to glean. There are no clear lines between oppressor and oppressed, no neatly defined victim group. At times, one wonders whether there is any relevance in studying a phenomenon that seems so exclusively Soviet. Svetlana Boym believes there is.
Perhaps Soviet civilization doesn't exist. However, sometimes I would even add, unfortunately, there's too much that does exist. Authoritarian mythologies still exist. System of dissimulation still exists. They speak about the need to deal with this propaganda art and the power of beautiful mythologies that do not simply manipulate, but also seduce and persuade and affect your affect you very deeply.
There is a palpable sense of tragedy at these three shows, an unwilling suspension of disbelief. The terror seems to propagate itself, a weave of frailty, fear, and misguided zeal that is infuriatingly difficult to unravel. It's almost like being seated at a dinner party where old friends recount an unending series of private jokes, jokes that outsiders can't possibly get. Except that no one at this table, not even the old friends, is laughing.
Here and Now producer Ken Shulman. For more on Gulag, Faces of Resistance, and Territories of Terror, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. As Christmas approaches, some dancers at Boston College are focusing on the meaning of the holiday as seen through the eyes of a dancing priest. Father Bob Varek is a Jesuit, a pastor, and the artistic director of the Boston Liturgical Dance Ensemble. For the past 26 years, he and his troupe have told the Christmas story through dance in a production called A Dancer's Christmas. To help dancers understand the twists and turns of the Christmas story, Father Bob asked them to walk an intricate labyrinth that's been built on the grounds of Boston College. Dancer and Here and Now producer Lynn Menegon watched it unfold, starting at a rehearsal.
Here they go! This particular piece, the first act of The Dancer's Christmas, has undergone many changes over the past 26 years. This is, I think, at least the third version. And what struck me this time was the idea of having an angelic companion journeying with these biblical characters. And I was looking for some image that would capture that sense of journey, not in a linear way. But everybody has to walk that same path.
What Father Bob came up with is a labyrinth on stage, not a set, but steps. Holding hands, Mary, Joseph, their angels, and other biblical characters form a human chain which snakes around the stage.
So everybody, it's mainly the end people, because we have to still see that pattern. So
Father Bob said labyrinths have a long history in religious practice.
The labyrinths were very popular in the medieval period, and it was this kind of a spiritual process that one went through. And people walked the labyrinth because they couldn't make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. The first stage is called purgation, and that is kind of letting go of all the thoughts that are in your mind, all of your anxieties and all that. And then as you follow this path, you eventually come to the middle place, which is this point of illumination, when you have a sense of your own center. And then the third moment is union. So it's in our piece, the Nativity piece, it's this the union that each of the characters have with the divine presence, with God. And that energy, that divine energy, particularly being channeled through Mary.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where.
Yeah.
Dancers then moved off stage and onto an actual labyrinth at Boston College dedicated to the 22 BC alumni who died on 9/11.
My name is Dina Melli, and I play the role of Mary, and I have walked the labyrinth before, but I'm real excited to do it with everybody. It doesn't feel like we're doing just choreography or just walking. They kind of blend themselves together a little bit.
Sarah Knight dances the role of Joseph's angel. She'd never walked a labyrinth before.
That labyrinth, it doesn't look so big when you see it, and then when you're actually walking through it, it's huge. That was like a shock to actually take all that time to get to the center. Was very you don't think that's going to be that long, and then you start on your journey and it takes forever to get there. So that was something new. Having the role, I've done it for the last 3 years. I learned every year, but having gone through this labyrinth now, it's making it more rich so that I can understand how it really feels.
With The Dancer's Christmas, my fondest hope and prayer is that people are really moved to celebrate the true meaning of Christmas as they see it unfold, and particularly through the spirit of the dancers.
Lovely.
Father Bob Varek, choreographer of A Dancer's Christmas. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. It's Here and Now. Among those putting their spin on holiday music this time of year is trumpeter Chris Botti. In just a few years, Chris Botti has gone from band member for pop artists like Sting and Paul Simon to being considered the most famous jazz musician in the world. Botti's blonde good looks and muted style often draw comparisons to Chet Baker in the jazz world, but Baker's albums did not debut in Billboard's top 20 as Botti's To Love Again collection of duets did last year. His holiday album, December, is becoming a staple this time of year, and Chris Botti joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
That's a very nice introduction. Thank you
like
so
that.
Much.
Oh, yeah. Good. Well, let's see. Let's start with a little history here. There was Sting, and there was Joni Mitchell, and Paul Simon, and People magazine named you one of the 50 most beautiful people.
This is radio, but...
You're blushing.
I'm blushing,
you
yes.
You are, you're
yes.
blushing. But you say it all started when you heard Miles Davis.
Yeah, I certainly think that... After hearing three notes of Miles Davis when I was 11, I knew that I wanted to live in New York City and be a jazz musician. It's a very powerful emotion when you can radically alter your life as a young person and do something so foreign at that time to myself, move to a city, want to move to a city, you know, have dreams of living in New York and be a jazz musician. When you just hear three notes from someone's trumpet.
Which three notes?
The first three notes of My Funny Valentine. That tone of his trumpet, the way that it had that melancholy, reflective nature to it, was just something that really stuck with me.
Right. But I read at one point that you said that after you moved to New York, you realized you didn't really want to be a jazz musician necessarily, and things started changing. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of approaches to jazz. You know, do you want to be a bebop jazz musician? Do you want to be an avant-garde jazz musician? Do you want, you know, all those things you need to like... decide for yourself and find your own voice. And I was very enamored with not only jazz, but a certain kind of elevated pop music. And that, you know, the way that, for instance, Sting is able to make music accessible and still operate on a high level is something that I thought that I wanted to do. And I didn't necessarily want to be a bebop, you know, traditional jazz trumpet player. That I wanted to make music that was accessible to a lot of people, but not dumbed down.
So how long do you think it took you before you were able to find a place where you were comfortable in developing your own tone?
What day is today?
You haven't gotten there yet. No, you know, we have.
You always, you know, you always, you're always kind of questioning it and searching. I guess I kind of have always been one to say that behind every overnight success is 10 years of Red Roof Inns. And, you know, and I've had all that. You know, I've been at it for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, on your holiday CD, on December, we hear Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. Mm. And that was the late Jeff Buckley's recording of the song, which is catching on now.
God bless you for knowing that. It's just that was, Jeff Buckley was in the studio next to me when I was recording my first album. He was recording his album, Grace, next door to me. Huh. And so I didn't really know much about Leonard Cohen, but through Jeff Buckley, I found Leonard Cohen.
Actually, we're going to hear a little bit of Jeff Buckley's version.
Maybe there's a God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who out to you.
And then your version.
Thank you.
just love the song. I mean, when I first heard Jeff Buckley do that on that record, I mean, he was so loved by musicians, Jeff Buckley was. You know, he's such a young man when he passed, you know. So it's kind of really a tribute to Jeff Buckley.
And why call the CD December?
I wanted to make a CD that didn't necessarily have an overt religious thing and also didn't have the chipperness of a lot of Christmas CDs, you know, Christmas with Chris, you know, or whatever, you know, like, right. You know, that you can get into. Sometimes, you know, this time of year, Christmas, it can be a time for a lot of reflection and a lot of melancholy, you know. Mm. That's kind of the cornerstone of my music. So, you know, I wanted to just make something that just was kind of didn't really point the CD in any one direction. Mm-hmm.
Of that, Santa Claus coming to town.
Yeah, you had to segue into the happiest tune on the album.
No, a little, you know, it's got a little different take on it, I think. Can you explain that one?
Well, I've always been a Jobim fan, and obviously it's just kind of a Jobim nod, you know, with Stan Getz and Jobim, you know. It, I think it works. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
It's cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Now, the jazz press has not always been very kind to you. They called you a smooth jazz artist, and they also haven't been very kind about the People magazine 50 Most Beautiful People.
Oh, well,
they
haven't been
list,
kind to me about
right?
that.
They haven't been kind
but
to
they haven't
about
been
that
kind
either.
My band has definitely not been kind to me about that.
But did you ever feel pressure to market your looks?
The People magazine thing is interesting. Here's two things the public won't know, is that as to sell records in this day and age, to really have mass crossover potential, and every artist, no matter what they say, would be absolutely thrilled to sell a lot of records, okay? And, you know, they might say
Even
something
if they
else.
They get criticized.
But, you know, the truth is, somewhere, you know, you're making music to be proud of, you know, to show what you can do and to be proud of it. And most television programs will not have any jazz instrumentalists on, period. They won't do it at all. They don't feel that instrumental music has a place at all in television. In order to get on television, you need a little bit of that pop culture stuff, like the People magazine thing, to just at least have it so the person can go, and our next guest, he was da-da-da-da-da, and then the music can come on. Now, if you can't step up to the plate with the music, you're not going to translate, hook up with any potential fans. And I'm not a 21-year-old pop star or a 21-year-old actor, you know, so it was a kind of a cool thing. I got teased relentlessly by my friends and my band. But those kinds of things act as a stepping stone to enable you to get on television. And the tragedy is in pop culture that if you put Keith Jarrett on Oprah Winfrey and he played one song unaccompanied, you'd have every single person in America going out and buying Keith Jarrett record. And that's something to really be aware of. Venues for entertainment aren't as open as your show.
Chris Bode, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Chris Bode's December CD is what we're listening to right now, his version of Ave Maria. Chris Bode live with orchestra and special guests is airing on local PBS stations through the holiday season. To find listings, visit our website, here-now.org. Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Robin Young returns tomorrow. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.